singing for us, leading a song for us. If you have your Bibles, turn to 2 Chronicles. We'll be looking at a passage tonight, 2 Chronicles chapter 16. And, excuse me, so 2 Chronicles 16, we'll be looking at verses 1 through 10. This is the fifth part of a look at the life of King Asa. And so we're looking at verses 1 through 10 tonight in chapter 16. If you want to read ahead, you can read for next time verses 11 through 14. And that will be the final study, if you will, on Asa. That'll be next week. But tonight we'll be looking at verses 1 through 10. Let me give you the outline and then kind of give a little bit of a review. We'll be looking at, if you take notes, verse 1, the problem with Baasha, or Baasha, depending on how you want to say it. So that's verse 1. And then a bad partnership in verses 2 through 6. So we'll look at the problem with Baasha, Baasha, depends on how you want to say tomato or tomato, verse 1. The bad partnership, verses 2 through 6. And then we'll see the tragic consequences in verses 7 through 10. Now, we've been looking at the life of King Asa and trying to look at some of the lessons that we can learn from him. Asa, if you remember, in short, is one of the relatively good kings of Judah. The nation of Israel had none, meaning the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom of Judah had a few that were relatively good. But one of the things that we've been sort of, and I've been focusing on, is that Asa's life reminds us it's good to start off well, but we need to finish that way as well. We need to continually be consistent and steadfast in the Lord, remaining faithful to Him throughout our lives. In other words, it's fine to start off and to be faithful, but we need to end that way as well. Now, I'm going to take just a few minutes and review, or if you haven't been with us for a while, essentially what you have is that Asa, he appears on the scene, and he appears on the scene once the nation of Israel has been established in the Promised Land, and they have had the, if you will, monarchy established, the monarchy meaning, of course, David and Solomon, for example, and then of course, we saw in the first study that after Solomon, what happens? You remember the kingdom is divided. You have Israel, the northern kingdom, then you have the southern kingdom, which is Judah. And though the predominant kings are bad, all of the nation of Israel, meaning this northern kingdom, they're all bad. The southern kingdom doesn't really fare much better. There's only a few that are relatively good. And so periodically, if you think of reading through the kings of Judah, it would be like this. He did evil, he did evil, he did evil, and it just goes on and on. And then every once in a while, one pops up and says, this one's different. They walked in the ways of David. And so that's an odd, if you will, anomaly, and Asa would be one of those. One of the reasons that God has these, and it's not the only one, is these good kings show what it's like to have a godly ruler. In other words, what it looks like in contrast to evil and such. Now, if you want a summary of Asa's life so far, if you haven't been with us, he's the first good king after two bad kings. For him, that was his father and grandfather. So if you imagine his grandfather was wicked and evil, his father was wicked and evil, and then Asa appears on the scene and sort of just out of nowhere it says he did right in the eyes of the Lord. So it's kind of odd. But one of the things, if you remember, that's important with Asa is the key to Asa's, his desire was in his heart to please the Lord, to walk in the ways of the Lord. So his heart was right. Two things that he did was the first thing is he removed false worship. But I make the argument that the most important thing that he did was he called the people to be committed to the Lord, but also to obey his word. And the reason why I say that is it's one thing if I were to come into Decatur and remove all the false things, but if I don't exhort you to follow the Lord and obey his word, you'll return right back to those false ways of worship. So that is, in effect, I think, his most important thing that he did. Now, for tonight's purposes, I want you to remember the first lesson that we learned from Asa was he had this massive army that came up against him. If you remember, that was the million plus. What did he do? Well, if you remember, he turned to the Lord, he prayed to the Lord, and what did the Lord do? He delivered them. He wiped out that army, and it was this overwhelming odds. He's going to have this same thing happen at the end, the latter portion of his ministry or his kingship, and we'll see how he responds. Does he respond in the same way? If you were with us last time, before we read our passage tonight, if you remember last time, the Lord sent warning, though, to him, King Asa. He warned him, but he also encouraged him. He says, if you get off the path, this is how to get back on the path. Asa responded well to it, and he invoked a lot of reforms. Now, I want someone to read verse 1, but as you read verse 1, I want you to think about this. Right after he took over as king, he established all of those things I talked about, but he had this large army that came up against him, 1 million plus, and he turned to the Lord. The Lord gave him a period of peace, but that peace is going to be interrupted by war. Where does he turn this time? Okay, so that's what you need to think in your head. Would someone want to read verse 1 of chapter 16 for me? Otherwise, you'll get stuck with the lengthier reading. So if you want to read, now's your chance to read a short verse. Go ahead, Gary.
In the 36th year of Judah.
All right. Thank you, Gary. So let's look at this. This is what I call, there's a problem that comes up with Baasha here. Now, it's important to understand, who is this? Well, Baasha, if you don't know who he is the king, you'll notice there, of Israel. So this is why I keep going back to, remember, there is Israel and then there is Judah. This is the divided kingdom, period, okay? This is not the period, I'm not trying to be funny, this isn't the period with David and Solomon where it was a united kingdom. Now it's divided. So this king, Baasha, he is the king of Israel. If you want to read about him, I'll give you this. We won't turn there. You can read about him in 1 Kings 15, verses 32 through chapter 16 and verse 7. So that's 1 Kings 15, 32 through chapter 16 and verse 7. If you ever heard of Jeroboam the first, this is his grandson. So what you have here is, you've had this period of peace. There's been a period of peace that the Lord has given to King Asa, the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom is the one that King Baasha is. And what does it say that he does? He fortified Ramah in order to prevent anyone from going out or coming in to go to King Asa. So essentially what he does is, he has this army, and they make this blockade on a road. It's not a road in the sense we might think of it. And basically what it did, it kept people from defecting from the northern kingdom down into the southern kingdom. Okay, so you have the northern king here, Baasha, and he has set up this blockade by his army to keep people from going from the northern kingdom down into the southern kingdom. And so that is the setting of this. Now, the setting of it is important because there's been this period of peace, and that peace is over. This is the early drumbeats, if you ever heard the expression of war. And so war is coming. He's got the northern kingdom coming up against him, and he's got this conflict. In chapter 14, when we started the study, Asa had the 1 million man plus army that came against him, and he turned to the Lord. The question is, when we turn to verses 2 through 6, where does he turn now in his older age? Does he turn to the Lord or somewhere else? And that's what we need to look at here, because you've gone from peace to now the Lord's going to test him. Will he go back and trust in the Lord like he did, if you will, in his earlier days? So let's look at verses 2 through 6. So would someone be willing to read verses 2 through 6 for me? All right, go ahead. Go ahead, Robin.
Asa then took the silver and gold out of the treasuries of the Lord's temple and of his own palace and sent it to Ben-Hadad. With them he built up Geba and Mizpah.
All right. Thank you, Robin. And good pronunciations there on all those tricky ones.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Now you see why I called verses 2 through 6 a bad partnership. Now you might be thinking, I don't understand what's going on. Okay, so it's fairly straightforward if you just stop and think about it. You have Judah. Judah is in the south. So imagine right here. You have Baasha here, and he's the northern king. Now, if you'll notice, we have a new individual that comes up on the scene, Ben-Hadad. And Ben-Hadad is the king of Aram, which is in Damascus. Does anyone know where Damascus is? So if you think about this is the southern kingdom, you have the northern kingdom. If you look at a map, it's up here. So it's far up into the northern area. And so what does Asa do? Well, he wants him to go, meaning this king of Syria, Ben-Hadad, to go up against the northern kingdom. Does that make sense? So you have the southern kingdom that's being attacked by the northern kingdom. Instead of seeking the Lord for help, where does he go? He goes to the king of Syria. This is the simplest way you can put it. Now, I want you to think for yourself for a second. The Lord had been with him and delivered him from 1,000,000-plus men. And here he is, and he goes to the king of Syria. And so what does he do? If you notice when Robin was reading this, he mentions the location, which is Damascus. That would be further north than the northern kingdom. But you'll notice what he does is he compromises, doesn't he? He goes to him and he says, let's make a treaty together, and then you go up against the king of Israel, meaning the northern kingdom there, Baasha, and he makes this compromise with him. Now, you'll notice if you do in verse 3, he says, I have sent you silver and gold. This is the same silver and gold that had been previously dedicated to the Lord. Look at chapter 15 and verse 18. You know, a lot of times we don't think compromise is really that significant, do we? Probably today. But compromise, there is always loss with compromise. By its very definition, to compromise is to suffer some sort of loss. But I'm going to read verse 18. So the prophet, a prophet has come in, and Asa does a series of reforms. But notice verse 18. He, meaning King Asa, brought into the house of God the dedicated things of his father and his own dedicated things, silver, gold, and utensils. So one of the things that he did is he compromised and he gave the temple treasury, some of those items that had been dedicated to the Lord, he gave those to the king of Syria. There is always a great cost when we compromise rather than being faithful to the Lord. You might not think so here, but wait until you see the end of this and then the end of his life. There is a great consequence when he compromised. He already knew the Lord would deliver him. If it was his will, he could deliver him. He had already delivered him from 1,000,000-plus. But instead, he in this old age, for whatever reason, he begins to compromise. And when we begin to compromise, we suffer. It's just that simple. The very definition of the word compromise means just that. It means to give up something. Before we go any further, I want you to just listen to this. It's from a commentator. And then next week when we finish, I'm going to read another part of this. Because the question came up even when we first started is essentially the same question. How is it that God's man, his servant, or anyone for that matter, knowing that the Lord will deliver them and that he will be there with them, and he had given an example of it, why would you forsake it? It's a good question. And I'm not going to say that we'll have all the answers, but I'm going to read you something here. It says, Asa then has done a complete about-face from his earlier faithfulness. This is referring to early in his life. It is as if we meet two altogether different Asas. He appeared first in the strength of God-reliance, now in the weakness of self-reliance. You see where the commentator's going? In Asa's early days, he didn't rely or have confidence in himself, but in the Lord. As time went on and as he got older in age, he felt like, well, I guess I have this confidence in myself. I have this confidence in my army and in my empire. I will go make a foreign allegiance with the king of Syria rather than seeking the Lord's direction. A lot has changed for him. It's almost like that, isn't it? It's almost two different people, isn't it? Chapters 14 and 15 show a man who is faithful to the Lord. Chapter 16 shows an older individual who is abandoned and is unfaithful to the Lord. Now, let's go on here and see some of the consequences of this, because if you notice when Robin was reading this, in verse 4, the king of Syria listened to Asa. He sent his commanders and his armies there. You'll notice he goes and describes all of these locations. And of course, he fortified Ramah, and it stopped the work. Now I want you to think for this before we read verses 7 through 10. From man's perspective, it looks like this went well, didn't it? But what does God think about it? Have you ever done something and you think, wow, I got a lot of pats on the back, a lot of people were happy with me. But ultimately, if the Lord's not pleased, does it make any difference? Isn't the Lord's view of us what's most important? Notice what happens in verses 7 through 10, because you'll notice that although man may be pleased, he may have been pleased at the time, the Lord is far from pleased. Someone read verses 7 through 10 for me.
You said 7 through 10?
Yeah, 7 through 10, please. Okay, thank you. So, Asa's scheme worked, didn't it? Well, from man's point of view, we might think so, right? But was the Lord pleased? I would say not. Not only was he not pleased, he sends another prophet. Now, remember, when I say another prophet, if you weren't with us before, if you go back to chapter 15 in verse 1, there was the prophet Azariah that came. He responded favorably to Azariah. If you notice here, though, we've got a different prophet. This is Hananiah. Notice verse 7 of chapter 16. Hananiah was a prophet of the Lord. Now, there is another reference to Hananiah. Does anyone know? Now, I wouldn't have known, so I'm not trying to pull your leg. I wouldn't have known if you'd cold asked me this. But his son Jehu is mentioned in 2 Chronicles 19:2. So if you want to read there, Hananiah is referenced there, 2 Chronicles 19:2. His son, somewhat of a similar role, if you will, to his father at a later point. So just trivia there. But you'll see here that when it was being read, you'll notice that the rebuke is that you relied on the king Aram and had not relied on the Lord your God. So we quickly see what his problem was, wasn't it? He felt like that he could do it himself and he would take matters into his own hands. So instead of relying on the Lord, he relied on himself or on something external from that. Have you ever done that? We all do that, don't we? And the question we started off the study with a few weeks ago is, how in the world do these kings keep doing this? It's the same reason you do it. We rely on the Lord, and then we get self-sufficient, we get confident, and so forth. And what do? Eventually, Lord, I'll call you when I need you. I got this all under control. And the Lord wants us to be consistently relying on him. And you'll see some of this here. It says, because you have relied on the king of Aram and not relied on the Lord, you'll notice that the army escaped him. You'll notice there's a little bit of, it's not so much play on words here, but notice verse 8. It's referring back to, were not the Ethiopians an immense army? That was chapter 14 and verse 9. What the prophet Hananiah is doing is he says, oh, by the way, you remember when there was that million plus army? You not only relied on me there, I delivered them into your hands. The king of Israel, the northern kingdom, wasn't destroyed. He just escaped. So he didn't really win too much, did he? He didn't fare too well. It's just that from man's point of view, we would think, well, the deal was okay. It all worked out. When we compromise with those types of standards that God gives us, the Lord's not going to be pleased. The man may be pleased and so forth, but not the Lord. I want you to look with me in the Gospel of Luke at something, because I think it's a good lesson for us. Luke 16. And just to sort of emphasize this point, because even in the church, we sometimes can think, well, if man is pleased and man around us is pleased and the world is pleased, then great. But you'll notice in Luke 16, in verse 15, I've oftentimes thought of this verse. It's right before he teaches the rich man and Lazarus, if you're familiar with this, he meaning Jesus. He says in Luke 16, 15, and he said to them, he's speaking to the Pharisees, he said, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable. In the Greek, it means an abomination in the sight of God. Folks, you may not like to hear this, but the fact of the matter is, God knows our hearts. And the things that man applauds, there are many of those that God sees as absolute abomination. Now, you think about that in our world today. Can you think of things today in our culture that man is rejoicing and they think is great? I can think of a whole slew of things. I can actually think of things that church members believe is okay. But in the Lord's sight, what is it? Absolute abomination. And what is the point Jesus is making? Not only that God knows your heart, what's most important is pleasing God. At the end of the day, is to please God. It's not to please man. Our natural tendency, though, is what? We want the attaboys. We want man to like us. So what is successful in man's eyes? Is it always successful in the Lord's? Absolutely not. Let's go back here and see something. When we were having the passage read, look back in 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9. Oh, such a beautiful verse. If you want a good memory verse, this one is a good one. I'm not suggesting there aren't other ones. But this one is just unique in its wording. And I'll give you another. There's another cross-reference that is very similar to this one. But notice, for the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth. Can you imagine? God is just seeking and looking out over the expanse of His creation. But notice what it says, that He may strongly support those whose heart is completely His. If you want a similar verse to this, it's Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 10. It's almost the same. The wording is very similar. Zechariah 4 verse 10. And so you think of the eyes of the Lord. Of course, it's not literally His eyes are scanning across the earth. Okay, so in case anyone was wondering, the Lord doesn't have eyeballs. If you didn't know that, He's a spirit being. But it gives this beautiful poetic view of God searching all of the earth. Who is He looking for, though? Well, He's looking for those who have a heart that is completely devoted to Him. This isn't half-hearted, partial obedience. This isn't like in James where the man is two-faced. This is someone who is completely, totally devoted to the Lord. Thomas Constable has this note on this, and I think it's helpful. He says, quote, "No problem can arise for God's people of which He is not aware and out of which He cannot deliver them." But notice the ending. He qualifies it. "If they commit themselves to Him fully." And that's what the verse is. It's not a blanket that God will do whatever you jolly well wish and He's just searching around for some random Joe. It's qualified, isn't it? For someone who has a heart that is completely given over to Him. Now, is Asa's heart divided like the man in James 1? Yeah, it is. It's a divided heart. Why? Well, he was with the Lord. He isn't with the Lord. He sort of is with the Lord. Look, we either are or we aren't. And God wants the heart to be completely, totally given over to Him and such. Now, in the passage as well, what else do we see? Well, at the end of chapter 15, and you could see this in the earlier part of his days as well, in chapters 14, in particular 15, because his heart was devoted, because he desired to walk in the ways of the Lord, he was given peace. There was no peace for them, was it? It was war. Notice at the end of verse 9, he says, "You've acted foolish. Indeed, from now on, you will surely have wars." So instead of having peace, literal peace in this case, what is he consumed with? They'll have nothing but warfare. It's a consequence of unbelief, of not being faithful and remaining faithful to the Lord. So instead of the Lord's peace, there's war. Notice how his response is, though. So the first prophet comes along, and he was pretty favorable to him. But sometimes the Lord's prophets, they aren't well received. Usually when you poke someone's cage, and I know this from pastoring, sometimes the response isn't favorable, is it? You poke people in their safety spots, and what do they do? Arr. Notice verse 10. "Then he was angry with the seer." The seer was just delivering the Lord's message. The messenger always gets the abuse. Notice what happens here. So then Asa was angry, so he didn't repent. He was angry with the seer, and what does he do? He puts him in the prison, puts him in the house of the stocks. It's almost like Jeremiah, you know, whenever they heard from Jeremiah, they thought, oh, please, I don't want to hear anymore, and they just kept throwing him in the stocks. There's something with man, and I know what it is, it's his heart is evil, is that when he hears the word of God, he either is open to receive it or else he just lashes out, doesn't he? Notice here he says that he was enraged at the prophet. But notice what else that he did. He began to oppress the people. You see, it wasn't just that he went after the Lord's prophet. His wrath had no end to it, and he began to oppress his people. So instead of being a, if you will, king in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of David, he got angry with the servant of the Lord for delivering the Lord's word, but then he went out and began to oppress the people. This is why he was only a partially good king. He wasn't entirely a good king. Psalm 37 and verse 8 says, "Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only leads to evil doing." And that's true, isn't it? If we allow anger and those sorts of things to stew in us, eventually evil comes out, doesn't it? What does James say? The anger of man does not or does produce the righteousness of God. Obviously, it does not. It doesn't produce the righteousness of God. Let me give you three things. These are just some takeaways, and then I wanted to leave some time. I try to, so you can ask questions or comments, but there's a great cost when we compromise rather than remain faithful to the Lord, isn't it? There's always a cost when a church or a Christian or whatever, when we compromise. There's always a cost to doing that. We need to remain faithful to the Lord. Asa should have remained faithful and left that, if you will, consequence, whatever was going to happen to him. Two, success is based on the Lord's approval, not man's. That's a lesson for the church today for sure, isn't it? We need to be less concerned with what man in the world thinks and be thinking what pleases the Lord. And the Lord is pleased when he's exalted, his word's proclaimed, and his word is obeyed. And finally, the Lord desires for us to have a heart given to him completely, but all the way to the end of our lives. And so that is what we have. Now, next time we'll finish the study of Asa, and you can read, I told you, verses 11 through 14, and his turmoil doesn't end. It gets worse.